Growing up in an American Navy family, Alex Kerr lived in many places, Italy, Hawaii, and Washington, D.C. But it was Kamioka, Japan, that he came to call home, and where a lifelong fascination with Japan began. He majored in Japanese studies at Yale University and later returned to Japan to live there full time. He's a writer, he's been an art dealer, house restorer, and translator. In his latest book, Hidden Japan, Alex Kerr takes readers outside the hot spots of Tokyo and Kyoto to some of Japan's lesser known areas and discusses the dilemma that tourism presents.
Well, before I get into that, let me briefly describe my background, which is, as you say, a Navy family. We lived all sorts of places, but came to Japan in 1964 when I was 12 years old, which means that this year I'll have had 60 years in Japan. I then went on and studied Japanese and Chinese in college and so, and in Japan also. And then later, since 76, have been here continuously. And in the meantime, when I was still in college back in 73, bought an old thatched house in the mountains of Shikoku in a romantic place called Ia Valley. And that house is still at the center of a lot of my activities, which include, among other things, restoring old houses. And I've done around 40-some houses around Japan.
And one of the things I'm interested in is that Japan is traditionally perceived as being quite a closed-off society, perhaps more difficult than nations that have had wave after wave of immigration, for example, more difficult to make one's home and become part of. But what's been your experience?
Well, that was not my experience. I've always been comfortable here. Now, it could be because I was here as a child, and I grew up with the language and speak. At this point, most of my writing and speaking actually is in Japanese. I think this this is the first interview in English in about a year. So I think speaking the language and having been here a long time makes a big difference. But in general, I think that Japan is one of these peculiar places where once you get over the initial hurdles, then it's very welcoming. And so that's what I've found.
We'll dig into the writing very soon, but it wasn't where you began straight out of university. Your first job was at the Umoto School of Traditional Japanese Arts. Could you tell us a little more about that?
That's right. Well, it's a Shinto foundation. It's one of these new Shinto religions. But by new, I mean since around 1890 or something. And their founder had said these rather peculiar words, art is the mother of religion. And of course, we would usually think it's the other way around, right? But he said art came first. And so they incorporate art into their traditions. And in the Omoto Center, they have no stages. And they had teachers who taught calligraphy and flower arranging and textiles and ceramics and martial arts and so on. And so we set up a school there for foreigners mostly, but also some Japanese, to study arts like tea ceremony, martial arts, calligraphy, and so on. And it was very intense. You wore kimono and hakama every day for a month. It was really a deep dive. And it had a huge impact on hundreds of people, a lot of whom are still active in Japanese studies and Japanese activities around the world today. And that went for about 20 years. And that's what brought me to this town where I'm speaking to you from, Kameoka, just on the outskirts of Kyoto.
You eventually became an arts dealer, we should say, and that, strangely enough, is also linked to how you became a property developer during the Japanese asset price bubble back, when was that, late 80s into the 90s. How did that happen?
That was a somewhat weird twist in that one of my college classmates, his father was a Texan real estate baron by the name of Trammell Crowe. And I went back one Christmas to see young Trammell, and he introduced me to his father. And his father, who this is the way he functioned, hired me on the spot. Said, I want you to do something for me. And I said, what? He said, well, you think of something. And so I was already involved. I love Japanese traditional art. I was already buying antiques for myself, and I was going to the auctions. So I wrote him and said, well, I can help you build up your art collection. because he already had a wonderful Chinese art collection. And so that he took me on. And pretty soon I was that gave me access really to the big dealers and the big auctions, and that really got me going. But I helped Trammell buy Japanese and Chinese art for close to 10 years. And then he asked me, would you help us do real estate development in Japan? And then that was the next pretty unexpected step.
You ended up managing the company's Japanese operations. As you said, you'd already been involved in Japanese property prior to that, but in a very different way, and you alluded to this earlier. Since 1973, I think you've restored more than 40 traditional Japanese houses, transforming them into tourist accommodation. How did you begin, and perhaps where did you begin with that?
Well, that takes us back to this marvelous, magical place called Iya Valley, which is deep in the mountains of Tokushima. And it's a rather, for Japan, extreme landscape, absolutely vertical cliffs and steep. The steepest hills of Japan, they're not the tallest, but they're the steepest. And on these hills, scattered here and there, are old thatched houses, and mist rises from the valleys. And I fell in love with that when I was about 18 or 19. And then, when I was spending a year in Japan as an exchange student at a university in Tokyo, I basically spent the whole time down in Iya and eventually found an old thatched house and bought it. And that was my start. And that house, called Chiyori, is still there. And it was the first. I then, later, after coming to Omoto after graduation in 77, found another old house, which I'm from where I'm speaking to you, in the outskirts of Kyoto, and that house, which is in the grounds of an old Shinto shrine, also has its magic. And from there on, my interest in old houses only grew. And by the 2000s, there was a sort of a turning point. I should say that I was no real estate developer. the house that I bought in Iya for about $1,800 is probably worth less now than it was then. And it's thatched and up on a mountainside that's very difficult to get to. But by the 2000s, Japan was tearing down these houses at a massive rate, especially in Kyoto, thousands of them disappearing every year. And so I thought, since you can go to Santa Fe or you can go to Prague or you can go to, Tuscany or something and stay in restored, beautiful old houses, people have done that now for a long time. Why can't we do it in Japan? And so we started with 10 houses in Kyoto. I raised money to help fix them up. And it worked. Everyone said it's impossible. This isn't the way people stay in Kyoto. But it turned out when they had the chance, they would stay.
And so, were you using them to bring higher value, slow tourism, it's called, I understand, right? To areas where people will stop and stay and engage with a local area. Is that the particular branch of the market that this responded or that responded to this?
Precisely. And since, for the last 15 years or so, 20 years, most of my efforts have not been in Kyoto City, but in very remote regional places. So we ended up doing another 8 thatched houses in Iya and a number of houses on a little island called Ojika and other valleys and islands and so on around Japan, where it's really desperately needed. Japan is suffering from a pretty drastic depopulation. We're losing around 600,000 people per year, and that affects rural areas much more than big cities. And so large numbers of these rural vi villages and towns are going to just disappear in the next few years. And their only hope is sustainable tourism, because that brings in not only the tourists, but it brings in young Japanese who will work in the countryside. It's a sustainable new industry. And so that is the aim, yes.
You returned to writing at some point, and I say returned because I think you debuted while at Oxford,
Oh, well.
somewhat. What has been the history of writing before you began writing award-winning work?
Well, my first published piece was I wrote an essay at Oxford. There was a thing called the Chancellor's English Essay, and I had run out of money. And I read in the a university handbook that if you wrote this essay, you could get £50. And I wrote it and I got it. And it turned out that Oscar Wilde and Matthew Arnold and all these sort of luminaries had won it before me. I had no idea. And that was the start. And I was studying Tibetan at the time, and my Tibetan teacher got that published in a little Himalayan magazine. That was the beginning. That was 1977. I later wrote a number of essays and small pieces in the 80s, but really got going with the publication of a book called Lost Japan that I wrote first in Japanese in the late 80s, early 90s. It got published in 93, and in 96, Lonely Planet asked me to do an English translation, which I did, and that's Lost Japan. And from there on, I've continued. Still, I've written
I think
continuously.
you were the first non-Japanese person, or non-Japanese born anyway, to win a very prestigious literary prize. And since then, you've gone on to write more than more and more books about Japan. Is there a central theme that brings the writing together, do you think?
Well, yes, there are two strands of my writing, I'd say. Lost Japan, and I've been a number of Hidden Japan, my most recent. These are lyrical books that talk about where the point is, here is the wonder. People think that it's this, but actually it's that. That's the deep thing. That's the essential greatness of this place or object. And taking you sort of behind the door, behind the veil. That's what those books are or try to be. Then there's another type, sorry, there's another type, which is a kind of journalism. And I wrote a very tough love book called Dogs and Demons and some other recent books that are still only in Japanese about the destruction of the traditional landscape, which really describe the damage done in modern Japan by ill-advised public works and so on. And why are these old houses and villages indiscriminately torn down, which doesn't happen in other advanced countries? Though that's another side of what I write. And so those are the two sort of yin and yang of my writing.
Is there an element of the Tibet then and now essay we talked about earlier? Is there an element of then and now that you have embraced ongoing in your writing, do you think?
Well, very much so, because a lot of, as the very title Lost Japan would tell you, a lot of this is either gone or disappearing. And a few years from now, we may not be able to see it anymore. Or it's become so disguised by the modern changes that it's difficult, especially if you're a traveler or if you've come here recently, to even understand what are you looking at. And so I think it's important to record those things. And to love them and revel in them and take the joy in them that people always used to do.
Alex Kerr is our guest. We're discussing his latest book, Hidden Japan. You're listening to 9 to Noon with Catherine Ryan on RNZ National. Well, let's talk about the new book. In it, you explore 10 of the country's less or lesser well-known spots. What was the aim of taking this approach to telling the story of your love for this country again?
Well, this time it was where I brought those two strands, the yin and yang, together. So it was the lyrical return to the wonder and the joy and the beauty, but with the cold eye of realism within the actual content and direction of modern Japan. And how could I put those two together without being overly critical or pessimistic, and still be looking forward and still keep the joy, I should say. That was the challenge, and that's what I was trying to do.
Choosing 10, in some way, is this related to the work or the knowledge you'd built up restoring those old houses? How did you choose these more remote places to write about?
It was a variety of things. Some of them I had visited because I'd been involved in old houses and had gone there to advise or to do a tour of old thatched houses or something like that. Others are places, they're legendary places I'd only heard of, like Aogashima, this island in the middle of the Pacific that's extremely difficult to get to. that I'd seen from photographs. Another one, one of the most interesting ones, was a little village called Tashiro in the north, in Akita Prefecture, where Butoh, Japan's avant-garde dance form, was born. And a photographer friend of mine, who's also a Butoh artist, had been there. Otherwise, I never would have known about it. So there was a variety of things that drew me to different places.
Could you explain to us the Japanese idea of omote and ura, which are quite central to the book?
Very much so. And in fact, I'm writing a sequel right now, which dives even more into ura, omote and ura. So omote means the front, and ura means the back. But there's this concept, which I think comes out of esoteric Buddhism, which the idea of esoteric Buddhism, esoteric means, really just means secret, was that there were deeper secrets and deeper secrets, and that you were initiated and you went deeper. And the deeper you got and the more secret it was, the more wonderful it was, right? And that applies to tea ceremony and all even martial arts with its levels of different belt, colored belts, and so on. You're always trying to get to a deeper level, a more to the back, which is the ura, which is not easily accessible. And so I was trying to go to the places that are not the Gold Pavilion, and that are not Tokyo Tower or something like that, not the places that people know about or can easily access, and try to get to that deeper level and maybe even go one step beyond.
There are some places you describe as truly hidden and others that you call merely forgotten. What's the difference?
Well, for example, one of the places I went to is actually two in the same neighborhood, just to the east of Kyoto, 15 minutes by train. Anybody can go. And they're very ancient and important shrines and temples, with some of Japan's greatest cultural treasures in beautiful environments. Empty. The foreign tourists don't go. The Japanese tourists, they know of it because it's part of their cultural history, but they don't go. And so these are what I would call forgotten. Whereas something like Aogashima, this island in the middle of the Pacific, is just plain remote.
Could you take us through a couple of your favorite places in the book? Tell us what makes them special. Tell us how to, as you say, unlock their secrets.
Well, we could start actually going back to Tashiro, this place where Butoh was born. That's the very avant-garde dance form. You maybe have seen images of it, where people cover their bodies in white paint, and it's very grotesque, and their faces are contorted and their bodies are contorted. But it swept the world. It has become a very powerful force in modern dance, and that was born in this town. And the creator of this dance form had grown up around there. And the thing was that he was trying to do two things. He wanted to get away from the polite, nice Japan of tea ceremony and people sitting in their lovely kimonos with hands crossed, bowing and scraping. He wanted to get back to something rough and primeval. And he found that in this village, which to this day has wonderful old thatched houses, rice paddies with large sort of wooden stakes lining them on which they would dry the rice in the winter. And he did a famous photo book of him called Kamaitachi, Scythe Weasel, which shows him in these various bizarre poses in this old village. And so what he was trying to do was to get back to something pre-modern Japan. And the thing about Tohoku, that's northeast Japan, is that that was in the old days the center of what they call the Jomon culture. The Jomon people had been here long before the influences from China, Korea, and the rest had been here for literally tens of thousands of years before that, based in this area. And Jomon culture, when you look at the old pots and things that we find, they're really bizarre, with strange flanges coming off of them and images of gods with five breasts and beards, and that was Butoh. That's Butoh. And that wacky, weird, bizarre Japan is still with us. That's why we have anime and manga and all these things that entrance the world today. But if you want to know where did it come from, you've got to go north.
Let's pick a second, say, and this is the Midira Temple, perhaps. You make the point sometimes in searching for hidden places, it pays to return to a place you've been to before and check out what's next door. What's here?
Meaning Need, it's called Midera. Well, the thing about Midera is that it was an esoteric temple that retained most of these temples at the in the 15th and 16th centuries were burned down, and a lot of their treasure was lost. But this one, by a kind of miracle, retained its treasures, and there you can still go and see them. There's a little museum there, but the temples themselves are treasures. They were donated by feudal lords at the end of the 16th century, and there are no very few such buildings in Kyoto, and nothing on this in Kyoto proper, I should say, and nothing on this scale. But also part of the history, again, kind of hidden history of Midera, is the involvement of the foreigners who came to Japan in the 19th century. And there was one, a very important one, called Ernest Fenollosa, who came here in his early 20s, soon was hired by the government to travel around Japan. This is in the 1870s and 80s, and find out what was there. They literally didn't know what was in these ancient temples because Japan had been broken up into 400 feudal fiefs. Right, the central government didn't know, so they sent Fenollosa and his disciple Tenshin, Okakura Tenshin, around to old temples in Nara, all over Japan, and they literally rescued statues that were about to be thrown into the flames. They brought major American Bostonian collectors to Japan, who saved a lot of these things and brought them to Boston, where they still are. And so there was this coterie of foreigners who had a big impact on Japan's cultural tradition. And they were involved with Midera. Midera was their sanctuary. And Fenollosa and his Bostonian friends and Tenshin, they took Buddhist names at Midera. And Fenollosa is actually buried there. And so way up on a little hillside behind it all, the grass overgrown where nobody goes, there's the mossy tomb of Fenollosa. And so that was part of that pilgrimage.
Just one more, perhaps. Jurassic Beach.
Yes.
And this time we're talking about beautiful forests on this particular visit, yes?
Yeah, well, Jurassic Beach is where sadly the Dogs and De that Dogs and Demons was the name of my sort of tough love book, where the sad part comes in. Jurassic Beach itself is this stunning, a kind of South Pacific tropical glorious beach on the island of Amami. But sadly, it's about to be destroyed. The government will concrete it over for no good reason except to spend the money. And it's been a long series of concretings that has drastically transformed Japan's entire seascape. And I went there actually to help the locals who were fighting it. And so I write at some length about that, and there's a just stunning photo of that beach in the book. If you look at it, you'll see what's about to be lost. But another thing I talk about in that chapter is forests, because Japan, one of the damages done, one of the disastrous policies was the cutting down of the native forest and replanting with a monoculture of cedar, and it's a true disaster in all sorts of ways. But modern visitors wouldn't know. How could you know? You're coming to Japan for the first time. How would you know what the original forest was? How could you tell when you look at it what is an original forest? What were the trees of the original forest? Those sorts of questions I talk about in that chapter.
One of the kind of juxtapositions you have here is that you're worried about what mass tourism has done to parts of Japan, and you worry about what is being lost. But at the same time, you're writing about things that make people want to come. Can you speak a little bit to what many nations are dealing with in balancing the economic benefits of tourism, but protecting what is precious also from being overrun? How do you want people to do tourism of this magnificent country that you love?
That's a key point. And actually, I think I'm the first person that ever wrote a touristy kind of book in which at the end of the opening chapter, the preface, I say, well, I hope you enjoy reading about these places. Please never go. Over tourism is a huge problem, and it's by no means just Japan. I mean, think Venice, Barcelona. I mean, nowadays, Galapagos, Machu Picchu. I'm sure New Zealand has this problem, and places have dealt with it in different ways. And Japan, sadly, has mostly not dealt with it. It's been chaos. And I wrote a book that's so far only in Japanese called Destroying the Nation with Tourism. And I should add that I'm actually one of the people that has been beating the drum for tourism. Tourism is, as I said earlier, the last hope for these regional towns. So Japan needs it. It's advantageous. We want tourists to come, but what we don't want is the damage from the over-tourism. And there are two issues, one of which has to do with how the locals, how the people on the receiving end can manage it through reservation systems and capacity restrictions and all these other issues. But the thing that I talk about in Hidden Japan is the other side. What do we as travelers, what should we be doing? And one of the questions I ask is, you might say to yourself, not do I want to go to this place, but do they need me? So if I go to the Gold Pavilion in Kyoto, where there are 100,000 people every day and it's mobbed, they won't notice my not being there. But if I go to Ea Valley or I go to Ojika Island, then I can actually have an impact. That's one thing. Another thing is, how can you do it as in a way that it's sustainable and it doesn't actually damage the local way of life? And of course, one way is long-term stay. So you want to get away from big bus tourism. And the thing that I think you may have heard this term in New Zealand called $0 tourism, which is, for example, the big bus comes, they all get out, they take their Instagram photo, they use the toilet, they drop their trash, they get back at the bus and leave. It looks great. The local bureaucrats say, whoa, 20,000 people came this month, but it was $0. It actually benefited the locals zero. And so that's not what we want. And so those are the kind of issues that I talk about in the very last chapter, is about this really pressing issue of how tourism can be beneficial and not harmful.
Alex Kerr, and his latest book is called Hidden Japan.